Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UA Little Rock Public Radio. The highly acclaimed Ariana String Quartet opens the Chamber Music Society of Little Rock's 17-18 season. As always, each year the capital city benefits from the high quality of programming that the society has established and the reputation its members have built through the years for their hospitality. The quartet members will work with students at Mills High School. My guest, Kurt Baldwin, cellist with the Ariana Quartet. And a quick review how the four got together, meeting as a foursome in Kent State, Ohio, to be the resident quartet, having been hired from summer festival performances.
We also started to grapple with some of the problems of how to play together and how to play in tune and how to interpret what was on the page and you know, how to communicate with one another. And we always see our work in the string quartet sort of as a quintet, that the composer is always in the room and is really the most important person. But, you know, when you're young, and we were young, this was 25 years ago, even if you've gone to a really, really fine school, when you leave with your master's degree, you haven't played that much music. And so, jumping into the Beethoven quartets or the Brahms quartets or Bartok is very, it gets deep and treacherous quickly. So we were very fortunate to, after 1 year at Kent, to move on to Northern Illinois University. And we studied then with the Vermeer Quartet. And that work was, we had a coaching with each member of that quartet every week for 3 years. So it was four coachings a week for 3 years. And so we kept up the amount of rehearsal, but then it was, that process was augmented by all of this information coming in to us, which was just phenomenal for us.
Well, it is quite fascinating listening to you talk, because I've been reading the bios of all of you, and all four of you have wide-ranging, exciting, and total solo careers as well.
I think one of the things that we love most about playing in the quartet is sharing those experiences. Mm-hmm. And rethinking them, also re-experiencing them, but with the perspective on what we're trying to do in the quartet. So it's always a fun moment in a rehearsal when, you know, all three of my colleagues went to Juilliard and had wonderful teachers there and mentors, and one of them will say, you know, I think I just figured out what Mr. Gallimere was saying about this, or now this is making sense to me. And, you know, we're still sorting through this wealth of information that we've been given over the course of our lives as students, but then also, you know, sort of folding that into our experience as professionals. The music really does give us opportunities to keep thinking and keep reinventing the information that we have. So it's very inspiring.
But you've brought a lot of diversity, and now you talked about the quartet coming together as though all four of you came together at the same time.
Right. Yeah, well, we came together at the same time, and then we started in 1992, but then we started, you know, I think we had a viola change within the first year. We had a violin change 6 years later for the first violin. So John Magrosso, our first violinist, has been in the quartet since 1998. The interesting thing about personnel changes in a string quartet is that, you know, the relationships, the way the relationships work in a quartet, there are six possible duo combinations in a string quartet. So as soon as one person changes, all of those duos that are in the string quartet have to kind of reconfigure themselves or redefine themselves. And so the interesting thing for me is I've been in the quartet now 25 years, but I feel like this is the way the quartet should have always been, or this is the best incarnation, because first of all, it's never sounded better, but the way we work now is we're so invested in each other that we try to be one organism for the composer. And so I think that's, as we've moved through the years when we've had personnel changes, that's what each new person has brought to the quartet. And for me, it's been fascinating to watch that process over the years.
And it's fascinating for your audiences, and I love being in a quartet audience, as it were, because one looks and becomes involved with the communication that you have with each other but also with us and with how we're reacting to your reactions, because we're breathing together. When
I think you're exactly right. I think the sometimes an audience doesn't realize how important they are to the experience of the music, because any performer can rehearse and prepare, but when the audience is there listening, there's a different energy in the room. And so our relationships change within the quartet depending on the acoustic of the room and depending on how the audience is listening. And I think the audience sometimes is surprised that it's as interactive as it is, because we really feed off of that energy of the audience listening to the music. You know, I think it's important to remember that none of this music was ever intended to be recorded. It was always intended to be performed live. Mm-hmm. And so that, exactly what you're saying, that spontaneity is the artistic experience. It's part of the emotional experience, too, of listening. So it's so demanding in terms of your listening skills, and it so quickly challenges every individual to be flexible, because you're listening and adjusting and adapting. And you know, that's one of the things our quartet believes very strongly in, is that the foundation of a great orchestra is for the musician, the students, to be playing chamber music. And when we love to go coach, change the dynamic. I think sometimes young musicians forget how important just how they move is how they sound. And if their listening is slow, then their opportunity to sort of engage in the music is diminished. So that's something we work on a lot, and it's very rewarding.
And you're probably getting back just to the four of you together, working together without particularly working on a particular piece for a particular concert, that you'll stop. And suddenly one of you will say, now let's do this, because I've suddenly had an idea that I know what I'm doing, which I didn't do before. And then you all work together on this and see how it affects your reaction to a particular
phrase. Yeah, the thing that's amazing about sharing any idea, I think it's a little like working in any sort of team, is that as soon as you share an idea with the quartet, it's no longer your idea. It's owned by all four members of the quartet, and it immediately becomes transformed into something usually that's better than the idea that you had. You know? We rely on each other with that, and we've just about completed the recordings of the complete Beethoven quartets, and we've performed those pieces for years, but to actually be able to rethink them and rework them, be very, very careful about what we're doing with them. As you say, we've come up with so many new ideas and new thoughts about what he could have meant by the markings that he gave us. And for us, that's such a fascinating part of the process. It's a little bit like being an archaeologist. We're always kind of looking and reconsidering what's the potential here, you know. And I think that's something we pride ourselves on in our work, that the next performance has the potential to be more effective. That's something that we're always working on.
Well, that gets back to questions about the program you're bringing here. So when you're putting together a program, you have to take that into consideration. And you've got a challenging program here with the Schubert and the Beethoven to close with, I assume, and the Janáček, he only had two, didn't he?
He only had two string quartets, and he wrote them both later in his life.
And one of them was very sort of emotional.
They're very emotional, and that, actually, that's the perfect word to describe them. I mean, Janáček's writing, while, you know, aware of what a string quartet, where it came from, his writing is so emotional and so psychological from the heart that we've joked in our quartet sometimes that it matters less almost what you play, but how you play it. His quartet is full of effects and shimmering sounds, shifting textures. It's very programmatic. He'd written hundreds of love letters to a woman, and this quartet is sort of a depiction of his emotional and psychological feelings toward her. And they're not altogether pleasant. Some of them have fear and trepidation, but then there's sort of, you know, there's love and affection as well. So it's a very moving live piece to hear. It's like almost watching a short play where that's full of drama between two characters.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the piece, the viola, as in much of the quartet repertoire, is sort of the heart of the piece, and it represents the woman infatuated with. So you hear the heartbeat of in the viola, and you hear these plaintive melodies that come from the viola. It's an incredibly effective piece. It's really fantastic.
When you choose something like that, and you've got Schubert's quartet sats,
mm-hmm.
which you feel must have held a lot of his emotion, but either he put it aside or he didn't live long enough to bring out those emotions, which he has done so incredibly well with his songs. And
right.
you just, it sort of becomes frustrating for these listeners such as us who would never have had a chance to speak to him or hear him live, to wonder, as you say, the emotions that go into work.
The incredible thing is that Schubert only lived to be 31 years old, but there isn't a piece in his opus that doesn't sound like Schubert. He understood how he felt and how he was going to put that into sound with harmony, rhythm, and melody. The same is true of Mendelssohn. I mean, Mendelssohn, some of his greatest works are from when he was 16, 17, 18 years old. He knew exactly what he sounded like, his sound. Same with Beethoven. You can't mistake Beethoven's sound. And how is it that all of these different composers managed to create all of these different inroads and views of the human condition, but with their own sound? And I think that's something that we continue to study and marvel at. And in the Schubert quartet that we're playing, it was meant to be the first movement of a bigger piece that he never got back to finish. But it stands so effectively on its own, and it's in C minor. It has all of the drama of a Beethoven C minor. But with this sweetness that Schubert brings, that must have been a part of who he was. There's a sweetness to his music inside that drama that is so personal, and we think it's the perfect opener for this program we're bringing to Little Rock. For going from Schubert to Janáček is a big jump in the sort of sound world, and then after intermission we come back to Beethoven, to this sort of epic Opus 59 number 2, which he wrote just after his third symphony. It's bigger than anything that had preceded it in Western classical music for a string quartet. And it's just a tremendous piece. It has one of the most gorgeous slow movements that I know of, and a last movement that just is intoxicating. It's just sizzling and an amazing ride to listen to.
Kurt Baldwin, cellist with the Ariana Quartet. The Ariana String Quartet is presented by the Chamber Music Society of Little Rock. 7:30 p.m., September the 21st, in St. Mark's Episcopal Church, Evergreen and Mississippi.
Safe and sound at home again, let the waters roar, Jack, safe and sound.
This is a fake news story and contains most of the essentials needed for such an endeavor to be believed. Witnesses. Corroboration. Darcy Patterson is an Arkansas writer and great storyteller. She explains how she has adapted this fake news story. The Nantucket Sea Monster, a fake news story.
I went to Nantucket about 6 years ago to research it.
So you had fun with it.
I had a lot of fun with this story and with the illustrations, yeah. Well, when I went to Nantucket 6 years ago, I was doing the research on Tony Sarg and this event, and they told me at the time that there was another author doing research also on Tony Sarg, and that was Melissa Sweet. She has a book called Balloons Over Broadway, which won many awards in the children's literature community. And I realized that my book was a dead book at that point. But I was never interested in a biography of Tony Sarg like she was. I was always interested in just this event. So when political events aspired, came about last year, I decided it was time to relook at it.
Well, perfect timing.
Yes.
So how did you start it? in terms of deciding the figures, the people who were actually going to be part of it, who were real people.
Yes.
And did you talk to some of them? Or were some of them still around?
No, they're not still alive. But what I did is I went to the Inquirer and Mirror newspaper. That's the newspaper published in Nantucket Island. And all of the reports about the sea monster that came out were from that newspaper. So you can get them online. They're archived, easily available, and you can look at the original reports. So that's what I did. And I looked not only at the reports, but I looked backwards and forwards in time to give some context to the story.
Did you actually turn up with anybody who can remember?
So when I went 6 years ago, there were people still alive then. There was a wonderful lady who's a scrimshaw artist. And she's passed away since then, but I did talk to her about the event, and it was fascinating to talk to her. She was pretty blasé about it. She thought it was just, you know, just a publicity stunt. But there were others of her age, her friends, that really were scared by the reports of sea monsters.
And did they, in fact, have a lot of people come by after this had been broadcast? The story itself, before anybody wrote about it.
Before anyone wrote about
it? Well, before the other author came in to write about SAG and touch on this, presumably.
Well, the Nantucket Historical Museum actually has online on Flickr an album where you can see the original photographs of the sea monster and Tony Sarg standing there, children playing. It was a famous event for the island.
And they make it very clear in your book that it was bred upon the waters.
It was a fake news story. Everyone knew it was fake before they published it. And yet newspaper men at the time still published the articles that said there's a sea monster on Nantucket Island.
So you didn't actually have a chance to talk to any of the people living. But I wondered how many of the people who agreed to be part of the fake story had to be persuaded, or whether they jumped on board at the thought.
You know, I don't have any knowledge of that at all. I wish I did. It was 80 years ago. Actually, it was 1937, so 80 years ago. And the people alive then, I don't really know whether it was hard for them to decide to do this. In the end, they published an article that explained what they had done, that it was a publicity stunt, and they said no one was injured. And Macy's didn't try to commercialize the event, so it was all okay. They tried to smooth it over and explain it was fine for them to have done this.
And they weren't breaking any laws or any rules or anything?
No. You know, in America, free press is a basic foundational tenet that we live upon.
Will you take that into account when you write round the story in your book? Was
yes.
that also made clear in the persuasions in the newspapers at the time?
No. No, the newspapers at the time just accepted that they could publish what they wanted to publish. So if you look at the accounts, they just baldly say, this is what we did, this is why we did it, this is why it's okay that we did it. They're not trying to hide it.
Well, at one point in your book, it kind of persuades them that they'd never have had this much publicity if it hadn't been done this way.
Correct. Right? Yeah, so they were very aware that they were getting publicity that otherwise they would have had to pay for. They said from Cape Cod to California, we got lots of articles. And I've looked them up. Again, you can look up historical newspapers. There were many, many articles all the way across the nation. It went out on the wires. So, yes, it got republished and republished. So they got publicity. Ironically, because of my book being published, they're still getting publicity about this event. A free press is the price we pay for a democracy. It's crucial that we have a free press, you know, and it's nothing new. Thomas Jefferson, I have a couple quotes from him. One says, where the press is free and every man able to read, all is safe. In other words, if you can print whatever you need to and people can read it, then they can make up their own mind about a political situation.
And you can get them refuted too. So people with some some standard in the community, if they say, well, that's not actually true.
Well, and that's our responsibility as a citizen, is to to call them out and say, no, that's fake. Why'd you publish that? Mm-hmm. You know, so I think this is a really good topic to talk with kids about. No matter what the political situation, you can go past that down to the foundations of what our democracy is and talk about free press, why we need free press, the dangers of it and the problems with it, but also the necessity for it.
Now, this book is going to be coming out on the 15th, on the 17th of September.
Yes, in September.
And have you already had requests to read it or to help disperse it so people can read it to children at this point?
I'm very thrilled. It's a Junior Library Guild selection. The Junior Library Guild is a book club for libraries. They subscribe to it and then the Junior Library Guild chooses which books to send out. So it is a Junior Library Guild selection for December, which is very exciting.
No, I agree with you. And I remember when my children were small that they got credit if they took this particular book away on holiday in the summer and read it before they went back to school.
Yes. Yes.
Very much so. And with this book, I would think, and with your illustrations, and how did you find your drawer, your illustrator?
Well, you'll like this. He's British. And he's a graphic designer. I found him for the first book he did for me was Burn, Michael Faraday's Candle. And this is the second book he's done with me. And he actually had to do it very fast. So I sent him the manuscript and I said, Peter, can you do this really fast? And he looked at the manuscript. He actually has vacationed in Boston area, so he sort of knew the Nantucket area and was very excited about it and pushed really hard, really fast to get this done. But his illustrations are totally wonderful. As a graphic designer, he just does layout and design so well. I couldn't ask for anything better. He has this habit of actually painting over old newspapers. So in some of the images, some of the newsprint shows through, and it's just delightful.
Yeah. Now, he lives in England.
Yes. Yes.
So, but he has the eye for the right scene.
Yes, he does have the eye for the right scene. He has a very unique way of working. He does one digital file for the sea monster, for example, but then he will shrink it, expand it, flip it, modify it. So he's doing more like a collage with each of these little files.
So when you got this story, as you've written it up, and the footprint is large and believable. Is this also part of the original story?
Is it part of the what?
The original story as it came out in the fake news with the footprint or whatever it was.
Yes, there was an original footprint. They do have pictures of it. You can see again on the Flickr account from the Nantucket Historical Society. When I was on Nantucket 6 years ago, I did research on who did that footprint. And I could not find exactly who did it, but there was something that suggested that perhaps Tony Sarg and his daughter, who would have been a young adult at the time, were the ones who went out and actually made the footprints. So I couldn't put that into the book because nonfiction, I could not prove it. I did not have enough facts to actually say, yes, this is exactly what happened. But I suspect it was he and his daughter.
Or having a great fun with a big hoax. And
they
to
did.
Believe that it went so far.
Well, he was a big hoax. He liked hoaxes. They tell a story when he was a child. He was sitting on a bridge in New York City, and he would tie a string to something like a pocketbook or something valuable and put it down where someone strolling along might see it. And then when they saw it, he would pull a string and pull it back to himself. So he liked to pull tricks. He did that all of his life.
I wonder how many times the people who tried to follow it tried seriously and got quite cross if somebody else picked it up.
He would be mad. You know, this hoax for the sea monster took a lot of planning and a lot of work. The sea monster itself is a huge rubber balloon. They had to ship it from Akron, Ohio, where the where it was made by the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. They had to ship it to Nantucket, along with 9,000 pounds of compressed air to blow it up. So just the planning of that alone to get there at Nantucket at about the right time was just an immense planning.
So they must have had a lot of clout with people to do that for them.
I guess.
And you can just imagine, well, I can't imagine, how on earth do you do something like that?
I don't know. And then once the balloon arrives there, how do you quietly, without anybody knowing, take it out to the to this remote beach to blow it up?
Yes.
You know, it's not a quiet, it's not a small thing. So
now, once it's blown up, is that the one they actually took to New York, or did they have to do another one?
I believe it's the same one, yes. So it, in this happened in August of 1937, and then for the Thanksgiving Day parade that year, the Sea Monster balloon did fly. There are historical photographs of him flying, you know, along Broadway. So I believe it was the same one. I don't think there's any damage to it or anything, so I think they did the same.
Now, what do they do with the ones after the parade is over? Is that still an existence, that particular balloon?
I don't know whether it is or not. I do understand that sometimes they would allow some balloons to fly loose, like a weather balloon would fly loose until it pops, and then, you know, someone would collect it and return it to Macy's. Mm-hmm. They stopped doing that practice many years ago. They just did it for a couple of years. But whether or not this one is still in some, you know, remote warehouse, I have no idea.
Yeah. I suppose now, with so much flying in the air anyway, private planes and jets coming in at odd angles, it would be kind of dangerous.
It would be dangerous to let them just fly away, yes.
Yeah.
They're very expensive anyway, so it doesn't make sense to...
It's not like a regular balloon that pops as it goes up. No. So it must be quite heavy then, when it's not full of air.
It would be heavy. They are made of rubber somehow. You know, and I'm sure that process has changed over the years, so that the ones today are much lighter weight. But I imagine back then it was very heavy.
Yes, because they wouldn't have had all these creative materials that
Correct.
We use now and take for granted that would be easier perhaps to do it.
Yeah, so when you take
time.
That into account, his accomplishment making these huge balloons is even more remarkable.
Was Macy's the only parade that he made balloons for?
I believe so. Again, I'm not totally confident of that, but I think so.
Well, when you think back, while you're talking, I'm sort of thinking of all the people that they pulled into their web to do these things, including the man who made the balloon.
Yeah, one of the interesting things when I was doing the research is I went back in the historical newspapers, and I tried to go forward and backwards, like I said, to give some context. And I found out that in March of 1937, Nantucket Island's government formed a publicity committee. And the people who were on that committee were directly involved in with this sea monster. So they were probably one of the most effective publicity committees ever.
One wonders just which particular one of all those people was the one who had the idea.
I do wonder that, and again, there's no historical records of the meetings that tell you anything like that.
I think if they probably had known who it was, it would have leaked and it wouldn't have had nearly the effect it did have.
Yes, and I think they all, I don't believe that they did this with a malice, you know, or anything like that. They were just trying to have a good time. I think there was some indication that they were even going to try to use this event as a fundraiser for the hospital. So they had good intentions. But when you use the newspapers to deliberately print something you know is fake, then...
You have to be a little cautious.
Yes. Yes.
Because somebody will have read that and said, but it was in the newspaper, so it has to be true.
Yes. And that's the danger. And that's why I think this is a great book for kids. Because I've read it to several kids, and at the end I asked them, do you think it was right or wrong? Should they have published that newspaper article or not? And some kids are just puzzled. They don't know. They haven't really developed their ideas about it. So this is a way to teach them about, again, the foundations of our democracy, mm-hmm. It's free mm-hmm. press. On the other hand, some kids are just outraged. They go, there's no way they should have done that. That was not right.
D'Arcy Patterson is a remarkable writer who finds stories that sound unbelievable, but are true, mostly. Puts her own particular seal upon them. The Nantucket Sea Monster, a fake news story, is being released today, September 17th, 2017, by Mims House, a Junior Literary Guild selection. And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UA Little Rock Public Radio.